A fully realized vision of an authentic American genius.
We need your brain.
Don't you have a brain in your head?
Then I will have to adjust your brain a bit.
Every day, Billy the Brain talks with the best guests in America.
Cool.
About business.
The boss that works for you.
Entertainment. Sports.
Turning now to sports.
And the local community.
Radio keeps its eye on local events.
It's time for brainstorming.
My brain is like mush.
With Billy the Brain.
Sounds like fun. Let's go.
Now, here's your host, Billy the Brain.
Hi, everybody. This is Billy the Brain, and you're listening to Brainstorming with Billy the Brain. We're on every day, Monday through Friday at 10 o'clock here on KKZZ AM 1400 or streaming over the internet at 1400kkzz.com. My goal is to bring you interviews with thought leaders in business, entertainment, sports, and the local community. Together, we'll listen to what these people have to say and figure out how it relates to how we live and work right here in Ventura. If all of this sounds like National Public Radio, well, then you're getting the idea. Brainstorming with Billy the Brain is NPR done right, with the emphasis on the right. Every show has a theme, and today's theme is seeing things the right way. Often, we get involved in the details and we lose sight of the big picture. Now, it's, I think, particularly ironic that our first guest joins us from Great Britain on the day after we celebrated our independence from that country. Having him on the show, however, demonstrates that like-minded people can be found the world over. Our distinguished guest has both the credentials and the background to speak eloquently on a subject. He's the author of several books, the latest of which is titled The Rational Optimist, How Prosperity Evolves. And I've read this book from cover to cover. I must say it's one of the best business books of 2010. Matt Ridley was educated at Eton and Magdalen College, Oxford, where he received his doctorate in zoology before he began his career as a journalist. Ridley worked as the science editor for The Economist from 1984 to 87, and then as its Washington correspondent from 87 to 89, and its American editor from 1990 to 92. And for those of you who don't know, The Economist is probably the world's best magazine out there today of any type. Definitely rivals anything we have here in the United States. Ridley was a non-executive chairman of UK Bank Northern Rock from 2004 to 2007, the period leading up to the bank's collapse. He's the first chairman of the International Center for Life, a science park in Newcastle, where he'll be calling and where we'll be speaking to him from. And he's formerly a governor of the Ditchley Foundation, which organizes conferences at his stately home in Oxfordshire. He is the son and heir of Viscount Ridley, whose family estate in Blagden Hall near, well, you in somewhere in Northumberland. He's married, he has two children, and he is joining us from Great Britain. Matt Ridley, welcome to the show.
Great to be on the show, and I'd just like to say that probably the best thing my country ever did was lose that war with you guys 300 years ago.
Well, of course, we would all agree with you. I'm not sure all of your countrymen feel the same way, but there you go. What I like, and the tie-in was, should we be calling you your lordship because you are a Viscount?
Certainly not. Anyway, that's my dad.
That's your dad, okay.
Besides, it's completely meaningless these days, and they've abolished the seat in the House of the Lords, so there's no point in it all anymore.
No, we'll just let it go. But actually, it ties into my first question, though, Matt. And you assert in your book that we should compare ourselves to kings of yesteryear, because in the old days, kings had people that did things for them. Today, however, we all have people doing things for us in what you call collective intelligence. What do you mean by collective intelligence?
Well, yeah, you see, I mean, as you've heard, I'm from a long line of distinguished industrialists, and some of them got rich in the 18th and 19th century, and they had a lot of servants, I guess. I don't really know. And so that meant they had a lot of people to do things for me. And, you know, Louis XIV, I've discovered, had 498 servants to prepare his dinner every night.
Wow.
Well, actually, you know, you and I have 498 servants to prepare our dinner tonight, except they're working in bistros and cafes and shops all over town. Because through the magic of exchange and specialization, whereby we each give our specialized labor in exchange for a tiny fraction of everybody else's labor, we can actually all work for each other, and we can enormously multiply our standard of living that way. It's an extraordinary phenomenon, and it means we can do things and we can have technologies that are cleverer than we can even conceive. In other words, that, you know, most of the things we use in everyday life, from my cell phone to my computer, even down to a pencil, I don't know how to make. They're made for me by millions of people together. Nobody knows how to make them. And there's this collective intelligence in which we are just nodes in its network, which has grown up around the human species over the last 100,000 years, but particularly in the last 200.
Right, and the whole industrial revolution. I am just absolutely tickled by the notion of, that you have in the book, you're of ideas having sex. You posit, as long as civilization engages in exchange and specialization, we're going to be able to reinvent ourselves and responsibly use Earth's resources ad infinitum. Boy, that's big time. Explain what you mean by that.
Yeah, well, I should qualify ad infinitum. At some point, you know, the sun's going to explode and consume the solar system. But we're 5 billion years off that yet, so I don't think we need to worry about that tomorrow.
Certainly not in our lifetime.
Not in your and my lifetime. What I mean by ideas having sex is that if you look at biological evolution, it depends hugely on sexual reproduction, because that's what brings together genetic mutations from different individuals and combines them in the same individual. Without that genetic mixing you get from mating, that wouldn't happen. Now, the same thing happened to cultural evolution around 100,000 years ago when we started exchanging. Because you can have culture without that. Chimpanzees have it. Chimpanzees have traditions of how to crack nuts in the forest and things like that. And they're all different. They all have different traditions, and they never mix them. They never trade, in effect. When we invented trade, we were able to bring together ideas and combine them from different parts of the species, different parts of the globe, different parts of the nation. And increasingly, we've globalized that phenomenon. So now, thanks to, you know, apps on the iPod or the cloud in the computing world, an idea can happen to somebody in Chicago, and he can transmit it to somebody in Shanghai. And before you know where you are, they've combined them. And that can all happen in seconds. Now, that means that the rate of innovation, because that's where innovation comes from, is the sharing and combining of ideas. The rate of innovation is bound to be going up at the moment. And that's where prosperity comes from. So I foresee a really good century in which we raise our standard of living. Can we do that without damaging the environment in the process? I believe we can, because if you look at what we've done over the last 60 years, we've trebled agricultural yields in cereals. That means that we've, without increasing the amount of acreage we plow, we've actually fed three times as many people from the same acres. If we did that again in this century, we would actually be feeding more people from fewer acres than we plow now. And that means we can start to regenerate the rainforest and link up nature reserves and all sorts of things. So actually, I think it's going to be a good century for biodiversity, as well as for human prosperity.
Well, I do too, because I agree with you, and I'm generally optimistic about the future. And I want to come back and I want to explore that, particularly when it comes to our carbon footprint. But before we do that, I just got to give a shout out to my listeners. I've got a couple of tickets to the Ty Warner Center and the Museum of Natural History in Santa Barbara. We'll be giving those away right after the break. So stay tuned. Remember, if you have a question for Matt Ridley, or if you want to win the tickets, the telephone number here is 639-0008, 639-0008. Now, Matt, you don't get too far from your zoology background at all when you're talking about ideas having sex and everything else. The subtitle of your book, How Prosperity Evolves, seems very appropriate, too, to a zoologist, everything evolving and that sort of thing. My question to you is, how'd you make the transition from zoologist to free market advocate? And more importantly, is it fair to characterize you as sort of Adam Smith meets Charles Darwin?
I would just love to claim Adam Smith and Charles Darwin as my two grandparents, for example, or two of my four grandparents, my two grandfathers, I should say. I'm happy with that characteristic. I think they were saying much the same thing. I think they came out of the same tradition, and what they were saying was, look, there's order in the world, there's complexity, and it doesn't come about because somebody designed it top-down. It comes about through emergent properties, and in Adam Smith's case, he's talking about the economy. In Charles Darwin's case, he's talking about ecology, and they're talking about the same thing. And my own career reflects that. I learned a lot about evolutionary biology and ecology and behavior and all the, and, you know, zoology when I was at university. And then when I became a journalist, at first I was just stuck writing about science, but, you know, I couldn't help noticing that my colleagues were all arguing about economics, and soon I was joining in, and eventually they sent me to Washington to do a job there reporting on economics, because they reckoned I'd learnt enough. And, you know, I saw the similarities between the way one understands a bottom-up economy in which we're all contributing to the spontaneous order, and the way life works, the way an ecosystem works, the way nature works.
I see. Well, we're talking to Matt Ridley, everybody. He's the author of the book, The Rational Optimist, How Prosperity Evolves. And we're going to have to take a short break. When we do come back from the break, I've got those tickets to give away to the Ty Warner Center and the Santa Barbara Museum of Natural History. So stay tuned. We'll be back after this short break.
Mark Twain once said, "A man who carries a cat by the tail learns something he can learn in no other way."
What you learn is just how painful a bad idea can be.
Mark and Cynthia Schneider for Pacific Air.
In this case, that bad idea is neglecting your air conditioner for another year.
Simple neglect is the cause of most expensive repairs.
Look, maybe your air conditioner can make it through another year. Maybe it cannot. But you can save a lot of money with a summer air conditioner tune-up for just $77.
When you think heating and air conditioning, think Pacific Air.
Nobody likes high energy bills or expensive repairs.
Maybe you took a pass on having your system looked at last year. Then it's even more important to get it cleaned and calibrated and inspected this year.
The All Points Air Conditioner Tune-Up.
Just $77 from your home comfort connection at Pacific Air.
866-PACAIRE. And on the web at PACAIRE.com. And when you think heating and air conditioning, think Pacific Air.
Yolanda's Mexican Cafe has been serving Ventura County the finest in Mexican food and drink for 25 years. Visit one of their four family-friendly locations in Oxnard at 1601 South Victoria Avenue, Ventura at 2753 East Main Street, Camarillo at 86 Daly Drive, and in Simi Valley at 590 East Los Angeles Avenue. They've been voted the best margaritas, best happy hour, best Mexican food, and best salsa bar in Ventura County in a survey by the Ventura Star newspaper and the Reporter News magazine over the last 10 years. Each one of their restaurants has its own personality, with beautiful decor and also beautiful artwork. Yolanda's friendly staff is always available to assist in providing an enjoyable experience when you dine with them. Yolanda's has been serving their customers the finest Mexican food since February 1982. Please visit their website at yolandasmexicancafe.com to see the many choices. Come share in the experience of Yolanda's Mexican Cafe, the best Mexican restaurant in Ventura County, Yolanda's.
Are you being audited by the California State Board of Equalization regarding your sales or use tax? The state auditors are now telling business people that have essentially service businesses that they've been mistaken all these years and owe huge amounts of sales tax plus penalties plus interest. You need to know what may turn your non-taxable service business into one where the state demands sales tax on your total gross revenue and how to avoid this. We will represent you with the auditors, appeals, and the courts. Getting representation as soon as you know you're being audited may be crucial. It may be the difference between preventing a minor case turning into a major one, or even criminal investigation and criminal prosecution. I'm tax attorney Steve Moskowitz with over 30 years of tax experience. For an attorney-client privilege consultation, call 888-TAX-DEAL. That's 888-TAX-DEAL. TAXDEAL 888-TAX-DEAL.
And now, back to brainstorming with Billy.
The Living Brain.
Now, here's your host, Billy the Brain.
Welcome back, everybody. This is Billy the Brain, and you're listening to Brainstorming with Billy the Brain. Our guest today has written what I think is one of the best business books of 2010. He is author Matt Ridley, author of The Rational Optimist, How Prosperity Evolves. And I want to get back to him, but before we do, I've got two tickets to give away this half hour for the Santa Barbara Museum of Natural History and the Ty Warner Sea Center. That'll go to the second caller at 639-0008, 639-0008. Call in and win. Now, back to you, Mr. Ridley. Wonderful stuff. I loved your book. And in your book, you write, most people are optimistic about their own lives, but generally pessimistic about the planet. You've got a completely different point of view, however. Explain how you foresee the planet's health is going to improve at the same time we feed and house 9.3 billion people.
Well, people are moving to cities all the time, and at the moment about 50% of the world's population lives in town, as it were, and that's going to continue rising as a proportion. And that means people are, the cities take up about 3% of the Earth's surface, but they have 50% of the people in them. And as we, you know, we like cities. On the whole, most of us like cities, particularly when we're young. We kind of move out into suburbs when we get a bit older, if we can.
That's right.
But cities are very green things because they mean that we are closer to each other. We our footprint in terms of how much land we need to live on is smaller. We're all closer together, so distributing food and electricity and energy and so on is a bit easier. So that's one way in which, actually, you know, our impact on the planet, you know, all over the third world, you're seeing villages be deserted and forests reappear in places. And that's already happened in, you know, parts of the eastern seaboard of the United States and so on. The other thing is, of course, as we get more constant, you know, if we switch from, say, using charcoal in some countries in Africa as a main source of cooking heat to using fossil fuels, then suddenly you're taking pressure off the local forest. And if you switch to using purchased food as opposed to hunted food, again, you're taking pressure off the local wildlife and so on. And as you get more concentrated in the yields you can achieve in agriculture, so you take the pressure off the forest there. So actually, I think that we will see. The other thing is, of course, as people get richer, they care about the environment more. When people get to about $4,000 a year per head on average, they start to really care about the environment. Up until that point, they say, I don't care if there's a species going to go extinct, if I'm going to improve my livelihood. After that point, they start to mind a lot more. And so you're seeing it in places like China today, increasing environmental consciousness. Now, you know, a lot of damage is done along the way, and I'm not saying the development of the human species hasn't been without its impact on other species, but I do actually think that we can live alongside biodiversity in the coming century in a better and better way, not a worse and worse way.
Ah, well, okay, that's very interesting. I'm going to throw a couple things out at you real quick here. I mean, I agree with what you're saying. I hear what you're saying. I think you'd agree it's scientific consensus that man-made climate change is actually happening out there. The question really is to what extent and by what means is it changing? Let me shotgun a couple of other scientific consensuses from my lifetime at you and get some comment on those. Acid rain, which was a big thing back in the late 1970s and 1980s. It was scientific consensus at that point that acid rain was going to ruin us and fresh water supplies and everything else. What's your take on that?
Yeah, the acid rain was a really interesting episode as far as I was concerned, because I covered it very closely as a journalist in the 80s, and I repeated all the alarmist projections, including the ones that Germany was going to lose all its forests by the year 2000, that kind of thing. These were coming from, you know, respectable scientific groups. They weren't just coming from the shrillest environmental pressure groups. And I kind of noticed, actually, by the 90s, that actually this hadn't happened. And it wasn't because of the Clean Air Act, because that had barely come in. In fact, the biomass of forests had been going up. Now, acid rain is not, does exist, and it does acidify lakes, and it does a few other things. But the idea that it had a widespread impact on the health of forests in the eastern United States or in Western Europe turned out to be just completely wrong, or at least hugely exaggerated. And that was just the latest of many scares. When I was growing up in the 70s, the oil was going to run out, famine was going to overtake us, a cancer epidemic caused by chemicals in the environment, the ice age was coming back, the desert was advancing at 2 miles a year, the population explosion was unstoppable. People kept saying these kind of things to me, and you know, I can't help noticing, but these turned out to be either wrong or greatly exaggerated. Now, I'm seeing a lot of the same kind of things in climate change arguments, for example, today. In other words, yes, there's a germ of truth, but no, there is no evidence that this is happening rapidly or that it's happening faster than has happened before or that it's entirely man-made. I believe there's definitely a man-made contribution or that it's likely to turn catastrophic. So I've certainly seen no evidence from the science to justify spending $40 trillion a year or whatever it is that we're going to be asked to spend. Maybe it's $40 trillion altogether, I can't remember, but a lot of money that the world is going to be asking us to spend to head off what might turn out to be a minor problem. We've got huge problems in the world. We've got poverty and malnutrition and malaria and things like that. Let's tackle them. And then when people are a bit more prosperous, they're more able to cope with climate change and adapt to it.
I love it. We're talking to Matt Ridley, everybody, author of the book, The Rational Optimist. He is truly, truly an optimist. But let me ask you, from your point of view as an optimist, we're looking at probably one of the biggest oil disasters in the history of the world right now happening in the Gulf of Mexico. The BP oil disaster, of course, is what I'm referring to. How does a rational optimist interpret that event?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It is a terrible, terrible thing that's happened in the Gulf of Mexico. And you know, it's shocking that it was allowed to happen through negligence and inattention, and there will be real environmental harm from it. But it's worth bearing in mind that if you look at the amount of oil spilled each year, it's actually been going down pretty steadily for 20 years, and it's down about 90%, despite approximate doubling in the amount of oil carried by sea over that time. We've got better and better at avoiding these spills. Now, each time one happens, we have to learn how to avoid that one, and clearly, you know, there's going to be some lessons learned from this. And it is worth remembering that the Ixtoc spill of Mexico in 1979, which was very, very similar to this in terms of the amount of oil spilled, it looks like it went on for 10 months. It looks like it spilled about as much in 10 months as this one will spill in 8 or 9 months, I think, you know, something like that. There's a similar rate of flow, in other words.
Mm-hmm.
That did real harm, the harm didn't last as long as people had feared. A lot of the ecology turned out to be more resilient than people thought. So, yes, this is a terrible thing, and we've got to learn lessons from it, and we've got to put it right. But it's the price we all pay for the fact that we like to have energy. And if we were having energy from other sources, from, you know, forests or windmills or biofuels, we'd be doing environmental harm that way. I mean, after all, windmills kill a lot of birds, particularly golden eagles, every year, just as oil spills kill birds too. So, in the huge global scheme, yes, this is a terrible, terrible thing, but terrible things do happen, and set against what's happening in the world, things are still generally improving.
We're talking to Matt Ridley, everybody, the author of the book, The Rational Optimist. And here's one for your data files, Matt, just for the future as you're having discussions with other people. The second biggest oil disaster in the United States happened right here in the Santa Barbara Channel back in 1969. We had a blowout on one of our wells, and people were concerned, about the oil and the disaster and the damage. And we had protest groups and everything else, and rightfully so. But improvements in the technology, improvements in the procedures and everything else, we haven't had another oil spill in this area since then, and everybody has been much more vigilant. So just as an FYI, the Gulf of Mexico has just eclipsed in the United States the Santa Barbara oil spill as the worst disaster there.
Now, very interesting. I didn't know that. I mean, you know, we've had big ones here. We had the Piper Alpha disaster in the North Sea when 150 people were killed in a blowout, and it took months to get it under control. We've had some very bad tanker spills on the coasts of Britain. And yes, at the time, they're terrible, and they do real harm. But I remember one in Wales where the tourist authorities the next year were complaining, we got such bad publicity about our beaches that nobody wants to come to them now. And actually, they're clean again now.
There you go.
A year later, it's fine. So, you know, we need to keep these things in perspective.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more there. Now, just real quick, we've only got a couple of minutes left. You were a writer for The Economist magazine, which Billy the Brain thinks is the finest magazine in the world. And you posit in your book that individual freedom, not government planning or humanitarian intent, is the primary engine of prosperity. What evidence do you have to support this?
Well, if you look at prosperity, global economic growth, it continues at a sort of remarkably steady rate of around 2% a year, much more steady than happens in individual countries. And it looks like what's happening is that it's people inventing ways of exchanging and specializing between them that's driving that. It's technology, it's innovation. And what government policy is simply doing is pushing that growth from one country to another. So pulling it from one country to another if it's good policy, and pushing it if it's bad policy. In other words, you can have a very volatile economy in one country. You know, one country can have a stagnant 20th century like Argentina, another can have a spectacular 20th century like the United States. And so it looks to me as if the source of it's people coming up with new ways of combining ideas, combining atoms, combining electrons, combining photons. That's the source of human prosperity, really. Human government is important. It's got to hold the ring. It's got to it's got to play the referee, but it looks to me like it does not actually generate prosperity itself. It simply helps get out of the way and let it happen.
Well, then, we're talking to Matt Ridley, everybody. Matt, how would you interpret this most recent round of regulation that we're trying to impose on the financial institutions after the collapse of 2008-2009?
Well, I think that's a slightly different question, because in many ways I feel that financial markets are different from markets in goods and services. They're prone to bubbles and crashes, and we need to try and find ways of stamping out bubbles and crashes. And there do seem to be some regulations that could help do that. But I'm not convinced but we must not fall into the trap of thinking that regulators are perfect and regulators are a silver bullet, because, you know, if you look what happened in the Gulf of Mexico as well as in the financial markets, there were regulators. It's just that they didn't regulate the right things. And if regulators are not regulating the right things, that gives false reassurance to people that things are okay when they're not. So in some ways, we need to be careful to we've got to have some regulation, I think, but we've got to be careful that it doesn't actually make things worse by giving people a false sense of security that things are under control.
Well said, well said. We're talking to Matt Ridley, everybody, the author of the book, The Rational Optimist, How Prosperity Evolves. In my opinion, one of the best business books of 2010. You should rush out, if you're interested in business books, rush out and buy this one. I can't believe how quickly the time has gone, Matt. We'll have to have you back. There's so many other subjects I'd love to explore with you. Thanks so much for being part of Brainstorming with Billy the Brain.
I really enjoyed the chat, Billy. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll talk to you soon. And now, big shout out to Yoli. Yoli, you are the winner of the two tickets for the Natural Museum of